Welcome, everyone, again to the Doomer Optimism podcast. Today, I have a special guest that I'm very excited to talk to, Stephen Stoll, author of this book, Rand Paul, The Ordeal of Appalachia. And I recently finished reading it. Really, really enjoyed it. I'm myself a newcomer to Appalachia. I've been in Western North Carolina for about 4 years or so, and I'm just very interested in the history and contextualizing myself here in my place, in this place. And this book was just fantastic for me to understand kind of some of the history, especially of dispossession of land and livelihood, and also relating it to broader struggles around the world for land related to the commons, et cetera. So welcome, Stephen. How are you doing today?
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Great. So why don't we start by talking about maybe a little bit of your background, what got you interested in the history of Appalachia in the first place?
Well, I'm not from there. A lot of people who write about the region are from there. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those kinds of places in the world where being part of it is a kind of a license for saying certain things about it. Everybody else is an outsider. I'm happy to be an outsider. Mm. And my contact with people in the region has been as someone who is considered an outsider, which is fine. Mm. But that was also what was intriguing about it to me. So I think all the way back in, say, I don't know, maybe 2005, mm-hmm. you know, like more than 20 years ago, about 20 years ago, I was teaching a course at Yale with two anthropologists, Jim Scott and Michael Dove, actually. And I was reading all this peasant stuff, and I had not read a lot of peasant studies. And I was just thinking, historians of the United States just never write or think about peasantry or what are called agrarians. And I just started thinking about this region and how I might try to understand it in terms of some of this work. And so it was really very much an intellectual interest that got me into it. And when I started going there, you know, I was just flabbergasted. I was just stunned by how beautiful and how kind the people were. And so I guess to answer your question, I got into it just to kind of say something that I had not said before and that I thought needed to be said. And I ended up learning a lot about it and kind of falling in love with it as a region. Mm-hmm. But I have no personal connection to it. I don't have like a big personal story about what brought me into it. I have no other kind of connection mm-hmm. other than I knew nothing about it. And I was willing to try to learn about it. And I learned about how much I don't know about it. And right. how much other people know so much more than I do.
Yeah. When you were doing your research for the book, what, in terms of coming up with, you know, what is the gap in the literature? What is the thesis I'm trying to put forward? What were you noticing that you weren't quite seeing well represented in the rest of the literature?
Yeah. It's not always how I think. I know it's how a lot of other scholars and historians always think. I'm kind of looking for a story that I can tell, and yeah. I'm going to tell it in my own way. Mm-hmm. Some of the people who have read the book and commented say, like, you know, like on Amazon, as an example, will say, mm-hmm. I thought this was a book about Appalachia, but it's really about capitalism. And they're right. Half of the book is not really about Appalachia at all.
Right. Right.
So what I wanted to do was to take the idea of enclosure.
Yeah.
And see if I could write about it in an American context, mm-hmm. outside of indigenous people, where you've heard that argument before. Mm-hmm. And there's some complications about whether or not it really qualifies as enclosure. It was dispossession, but it may not be enclosure. Yeah. But I wanted to try to write about capitalism and the coming of capitalism in a way that was critical, mm-hmm. And how it affected an American peasantry in this place. And I certainly had not seen that done before.
Yeah. Yeah.
By an American historian.
Okay. Okay. One distinction you make in the book is the distinction between quasi self-sufficient communities who still engage with the market for some things in order to get resources that they need, capital that they need, and you know, more of what we would call capitalism itself. And do you want to talk a little bit about that distinction, about like kind of local markets, I guess you can say, or even local communities that are connected to larger markets versus this more extractive notion of capitalism that you describe?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. Yeah, mm-hmm. This is definitely something that I learned from the economic anthropologists. Mm-hmm. And if there's one thing about people who essentially live in agrarian households and who produce things for subsistence, if there's one thing I want readers to understand, mm-hmm. is that such people engage in markets. No one is isolated from a market. No one ever wants to be. Markets are great. Mm-hmm. Markets give you cool stuff. But that there's a difference between deriving your survival and subsistence from a market, which is what happens when I take your land away from you and I pay you a wage. Mm-hmm. Then you have to exchange that wage for everything that you need.
Right. Right.
But if the market is a pure opportunity, because you have this other way of living, mm-hmm. and you then can turn part of your labor inland mm-hmm. into something that you can sell and realize something from the market that is just fantastic, a luxury good, or books, or clothing, or something from far away, you're in a much different position than the wage earner. But I think the misunderstanding is that you're either part of a market or you're isolated from markets.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, again, it's the economic anthropologists, a lot of them working in Central America, who are really the ones who have written about this, like Enrique Mayer mm-hmm. and Stephen Gudeman. But that the market is an opportunity. Mm-hmm. It's a good slave, but a bad master. And to use that language.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they were well familiar with money and with markets. But what they understood very well is you don't want to go to a place in which you depend on that for your survival. That takes away your freedom.
Right.
They understood that intuitively. That didn't have to be explained to them, and moving down to the coal camp or the lumber camp mm-hmm. when they could no longer make it on the ridge in the hollow because that forest had been destroyed because their wherewithal had been pulled out from under their feet. All they wanted was to find their way back.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Can we go through a bit of kind of the history that you find salient and kind of drawing out the story? So a few things that stuck out to me were, you know, the rise of the railroads. Even before that, you had the absentee landowners from the Revolutionary War and around that time period, and people coming to settle anyway, so-called squatters, and then, you know, trying to use their work in the place to as a criteria for, you know, for ownership of that place, and then the kind of just these larger economic forces that started to dispossess people of their ecological base.
Yeah, so I would break it into like two different eras okay. of capitalism. The mm-hmm. first thing to talk about, say, the 18th century. Mm-hmm. and maybe even all the way to the Civil War, is that a lot of people think of the pioneers. They think of Daniel Boone rolling mm-hmm. through Cumberland Gap, you know, into Kentucky. When these pioneers arrived, all that land was already owned. It was already part of Virginia, if we're talking about Western Virginia, but the same went for, say, large portions of Kentucky and the Carolinas. Mm-hmm. And that is that these states saw this land as a liability, and they wanted wealthy people to own it and to pay them basically property taxes and hopefully do something like it, like open a plantation out mm-hmm. there in the Western counties. That was never going to happen. Mm-hmm. the thing is that people like Robert Morris and George Washington owned enormous thousands of acres in the western counties of Virginia before anybody showed up to live there in those hollows. Mm-hmm. And that's not well understood. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of those capitalists was that that land would somehow rise in value, and they would sell it and they would make money on what we call speculation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They would somehow, value would basically accrue in the land, and it was really vague how that would happen. And in fact, it didn't happen at all. It didn't happen. Right. And all of these people who came in, the reason why they could hide in the hollows is because Robert Morris and George Washington never visited there. They didn't do anything with it. Washington had portions of it surveyed for the possibility of selling it, or of maybe even establishing a plantation, not his plantation, right? But he didn't do that. And so they thrived in the corners and up in the higher elevations because these owners just had no plans for it. That was capitalism in the mountains 1.0.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
2.0 is after the Civil War, mm-hmm. and everything changed. Because what happened was coal, lumber, and railroads, especially coal. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Steam engines were beginning to burn coal because they worked a lot better and they burned so much hotter on coal. Mm-hmm. And coal was beginning to catch on. And there were people who had surveyed and said, you know what? Out there where nothing is happening, mm-hmm. there is coal out there. Mm-hmm. It's in central Pennsylvania and it works its way all down into northern West Virginia, and they didn't know it, but tons of it in southern West Virginia. Well, mm-hmm. during the Civil War, some of these geologists and geographers, while they were working for the Confederacy, were seeing these coal seams, you know, down in these southern counties. And after the war, they said, you can't believe how much coal there is. And this became popularized. 2.0, just to come to the point, yeah. is a different generation of capitalists who wanted the full-scale economic extraction, exploitation of those mountains. They were not interested in just waiting for the price of land to increase. Mm-hmm. They wanted to send railroads into it, cut down all the trees, and dig coal mines. Mm-hmm. And that began the crisis between them and the settler culture mm-hmm. that was thriving in the hollows. Yeah, they were in for big, big trouble.
Yeah. And what were some of the methods by which the capitalist 2.0 forces dispossessed people of the land? You get into various ways that they, you know, that they basically were able to take over certain parcels, et cetera.
Yeah. It's funny because right now I'm writing a book about land and I'm working on a chapter about commons. Mm-hmm. And commons are always described as customary. And a custom is a claim on centralized authority. It's something that people have done for a long, long time that they demand have precedence over things that are new ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. What happened when the industrialists, let's call them that, when they came in, mm-hmm. is they said, look, I've got a deed with George Washington's name on it. See this? He owned all these acres and I now own a portion of it from George Washington's deed. What do you have? And they said, well, we've been writing our own deeds for a long time. Mm-hmm. So that we basically have a kind of common law deed. We've lived here for a long time, but we buy and sell land and we actually write it down. Mm-hmm. And we exchange these deeds. And they would bring it to the judge and the judge would have to decide, do I accept the common law deed mm-hmm. that no one has challenged for 100 years? Or the deed that comes from George Washington's land, which by the way, was granted by, say, like the last colonial governor of Virginia. Mm-hmm. Do I grant that one? Very often the judges sided with the settlers. Mm-hmm. They did for quite a long time and said to the industrialists, where have you been? Like these people have lived here and they've developed this land. But after a certain point, especially after West Virginia became a state, the judges began to change and they began to understand that honoring the industrial deeds was going to lead to the extraction of all of this stuff that would be turned into wealth. Mm-hmm. And they turned against what I would call the common law deed. Mm-hmm. It's more complicated than that, and you don't want me to explain it here. But different courts and even legislatures weighed in on exactly what to do with these other claims.
Yeah.
Even diminishing them and saying, well, you can stay on it, but we're not going to actually call that really a legal deed. We're going to call it something a little lesser, like you have a use right, even though someone else might own it outright, legally. It was complicated, but what it really allowed for is for these people ultimately to lose control of the land.
Okay. One chapter that I found really interesting was talking about these coal mining towns, and especially, well, one, the fact that the coal miners usually had gardens, but and so they had some of their own sense of kind of food self-sufficiency, but the coal mines actually use this to their advantage to pay them less. So it was actually this adverse incentive in a way. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? That was something
I was fascinated by the gardens, and I just thought they're playing this role. There are all of these gardens, and then there'd be people who would win a prize from the coal company for the best garden. And I just thought, what is that about? Mm-hmm. And I saw a reference in another book of the president of the United Mine Workers getting a tour of these towns and commenting on the gardens. And I thought, there is more going on here. And so I went up to the University of Connecticut, and I didn't want to go. It was a long trip. I'm looking for but I wanted to read the United Mine Workers, and no library had it. Mm-hmm. So I basically dug this article out, and it was incredible because the president of the United Mine Workers said to his tour guide, look at all these gardens. These people are so industrious. Mm-hmm. And the tour guide said, you better believe they're industrious. They can mine coal for next to nothing, which meant that he was saying that the gardens were basically a source of exploitation. Mm-hmm. By growing their own food, they didn't have to be paid as much in cash. Right. They essentially were producing their own subsistence, like as though they were serfs working on the Lord's domain. Mm-hmm. And, now I get it. These households are producing this food. The head of the household is earning wages, which are not. He's giving the wages back to the company, and the company's store is getting flour and pork, basically. And all the vegetables are giving them a really good diet, right? Vegetables are great. You live a lot longer eating vegetables than not. And so they were actually fairly healthy. But they were producing all of this food when there was zero money actually changing hands. They were like sharecroppers.
Yeah.
And like many of them didn't actually have any cash at all changing hands. So the garden made the towns more beautiful. It gave them a sense of belonging and connection. It gave them high quality food. But at the same time, it was weirdly causing dependency and even impoverishing in a certain way. It's a strange phenomenon, how it played both of these roles.
That definitely gave me food for thought. And later we'll talk about kind of modern implications and maybe weave that back in. But I want to dig more into, and this is not just specific to Appalachia. This seems to be a common pattern around the world in the history of enclosure, of kind of undermining a community's resource base, where they can no longer be self-sufficient, and then they're forced into wage labor, right? And this is also kind of part of the distinction between community markets and capitalism, where suddenly you're forced to become a wage laborer, you're forced into the formal economy, and you lose a lot of freedom, a lot of autonomy that way. Do you want to just talk about that dynamic, even the broader historical kind of context of that?
Yeah. No, it's really powerful, and it's not well understood, because so many people out there, they think about capitalism as freedom. Mm-hmm. as kind of individual freedom. And I can buy and sell something that I want to, and I can be an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And capitalism does depend on and require a certain kind of freedom. It really does. Mostly the freedom to enter into contracts. Mm-hmm. It's actually a very narrow kind of freedom. And as so many commentators, peasants in the 17th and 18th and 19th century never tired of this. People like Gerard Winstanley said, it's a pathetic kind of freedom. Mm-hmm. Poverty is not freedom. If you're starving on wages, you're not really free. But liberalism didn't see that. John Locke couldn't see that lack of freedom. He only saw kind of the freedom to own things, the freedom to buy and sell things. And so just as you said, it is possible to debase an environment to the point that people can't make a living on it. And then what happens is that in order to replace what the freedom of markets once did, their freedom to willingly participate in a market, the only way to replace that money is wages. Yeah. So many of them will actually voluntarily earn a wage, not understanding that it's like a trap door, mm-hmm. and it'll slam shut and they won't be able to open it again. And that is, once you become dependent on the wages and the landscape no longer supports you because it's been degraded or taken from you, all you have is the wage. And then you realize you've been had, that you've been trapped. And this happens all over the place. Mm-hmm. It happened for the first time in England, and it happened in Appalachia. But the people who kind of believe in capitalism as progress, mm-hmm. they can't see that. They just say, well, they were poor and now they have money. They lived on, you know, zero money a day, and now they have so much money each day. And they just can't see the contradiction, and that money is impoverishing. For a lot of people, is scrambling. Yeah. They don't get it, you know, but money is impoverishing.
Yeah. Yeah. Somewhat related chapter I found really interesting was when you were talking about the Whiskey Rebellion and the strategy of Alexander Hamilton and others to tax for the first time not sales but actual production of whiskey, which, as you described, was one of the major sources of wealth for these communities in terms of what they could trade. And do you want to talk a little bit about this? Yeah. And kind of what the implications of this were for, you know, for this whole process?
Your listeners and or viewers are going to think this is just a crazy book. Alexander Hamilton? Uh-huh. Out of your mind? Uh-huh. And I am a little bit out of my mind. It was the hardest chapter to write. Mm-hmm. But actually, I began with it because I thought the Whiskey Rebellion in Southern Pennsylvania, that took place in Appalachia, but no one ever considers it a story of the mountains that would be linked to events really not very many years later, like in the early 19th century. We start talking about a distinct mountain culture. But mm-hmm. like after the American Revolution, it's like the Western United States and the Federalists are kind of at war with these settlers over this tax. And people who are strong supporters of the federal government said, no, you have to pay this tax. This is right. It supports the government. And mm-hmm. I just wanted to try to figure out what was happening here and what it might say about what we call Appalachia, a term and a region that we don't really talk about until much later.
Mm. Right.
So I had to take a big breath and break into Alexander Hamilton and why was he doing this? And of course, a lot has been written about it. And I actually thought it was sort of inadequate. Mm. It didn't have an environmental angle to it. And I think that he understood very, very well the role that whiskey played in the lives of these people, which is they were able to produce something, rye, which gave them all of this flexibility. They could eat it themselves in bread. You know, that really dense German bread that you can buy?
Yeah.
You know, one of them is called like athletic bread or like healthy bread or something, right? Right. That is real rye bread. Mm-hmm. It kind of defies classification as bread. You know, if you threw it out a window, you break the window. I actually really like it. That's what they made. They also fed it to their livestock. But then this third thing was really the magic. It was this explosive thing. They could take something they produced with very minimal labor on their land and turn it into something that had a stable value that they could trade hundreds of miles away and it would never degrade. They could drink it themselves.
Right.
It was, it's not really a currency if you can eat it or drink it. It is currency. It's a currency-like thing.
Yeah.
In that it's stable, but it itself is meant to be consumed. And it was magic. They could exchange it for almost anything. And Hamilton wanted to kind of bring them into the United States. Hamilton and Washington were really, really worried about Western Pennsylvania. They believed all of these conspiracy theories. Yes, they were actually conspiracy theories that they were going to join Spain. They were going to break away. What kept Hamilton up at night was that a part of the United States was not really integrated into its economy. And his genius, no matter what you think about it, all right, his total genius was to say a nation state is a place where the rule of law governs every single inch in exactly the same way. It is not what any kind of state was before. So he imagined this tax. I believe that this tax had nothing to do with raising revenue for the United States. It didn't have to do with money in its treasury, as taxes really don't today. It had to do with forcing people into cycles of buying and selling in order to pay taxes that would bind them to the federal government. And whiskey was something he could tax. How could you tax cattle? It's here today, gone tomorrow. How can you tax a field of rye? Same thing. A pig? But whiskey traveled. And so the whiskey tax was his way of essentially reaching into that relationship and forcing them to produce for the, basically for the market.
Right.
So I think I make a circumstantial case for it.
And you want to talk about the difference between, it wasn't just a sales tax, it was a production tax. And why, why does that distinction matter?
Yeah, people don't get like, right. Like you would think the whiskey tax was a tax on the consumer buying the whiskey, like a sales tax.
Yeah.
And no, an excise tax is a tax on the production of something. And to be fair to Hamilton, it really depended on the size of the still. If your still was small enough, there actually was no tax.
Yeah.
It didn't have to be too big in order for there to be a tax on it. So it was a tax on the capacity of the still that you had to pay before the whiskey was made. You had to pay it in advance. Oh, and it made people just so mad.
So mad.
So mad that they refused to do it. And when Washington raised an army, by the way, commander in chief, there's only one time ever that the president literally behaved, literally was commander in chief at the head of a 12, 13,000 person army, pointing his sword at the Western Hills. That was when George Washington led that army halfway into Western Pennsylvania. The idea that he would himself go to war with American citizens, yeah, he didn't like that idea. So he said to Alex, Alex, it's all you, baby. You take over. And Alex said, you got it, Dad. I mean, General Washington. And so he put on his his Revolutionary War uniform. And he led that column into the mountains. But they came down and they blew up. They blew holes in the road to stop them. They did a kind of guerrilla warfare. They threw fruit at them. They called them the Watermelon Army. I don't know. No one really knows why the Alexander Hamilton's army was called the Watermelon Army. I really don't know why. But they mocked it. And Yeah, they made it very clear that this is not something that should ever be taxed.
Yeah. Yeah. And the tax was lifted later by Jefferson. Is that correct?
Yeah, after the rebellion, you know, there were a couple of trials, there were like three convictions, mm-hmm. and Washington used the pardon for the very first time. Mm-hmm. And he pardoned them because they really were embarrassed. And they just wanted this to go away. Yes, Jefferson had resigned from the administration because of the whiskey tax. And the first thing he did, actually, I don't know if it was literally the first thing he did, but it may have been the first thing he did, was to sign a bill into law for its repeal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. you mentioned earlier about, you know, whether this process could technically be called enclosure. You mentioned the prior, you know, indigenous populations. Originally, you had the Mississippians and then the Cherokee and other groups. And you don't get too much into that in this book, although you do mention it a few times. And, you know, the process of dispossession earlier on. Do you want to talk about kind of, you know, how you compare and contrast these kind of two waves, you know, of dispossession? First of the indigenous populations. And of course, this is a multi-hundred year process, and there are waves of different settlers, Spanish originally, and then, you know, Germans and French and English and Scots-Irish and et cetera. And then, of course, you have where I am, you had the Trail of Tears in the, you know, 1830s. And so you have this kind of, and then one thing that kind of blew my mind, I hadn't thought about in the book, is you were talking about how many of the settlers into the States were former, say, English peasants who had also lost their land, who had experienced enclosure. And so they were coming here to, you know, to basically get a fresh start. And so it was kind of like the term in my mind was kind of enclosure begets enclosure in a way. You want to talk about just kind of comparing and contrast in that kind of longer historical context?
Sure. There's a wonderful book by a historian named Alan Greer called, you know, I have it here. I have an article by him too. Yeah, it's called like Property and Dispossession. Mm-hmm. And he really makes this argument that what came ashore in 1620 was not private property. Mm-hmm. That in fact, we think of the commons and commons customs as kind of good and just, and we set it apart and we set it against private property. And there's good reasons for why we do that. It absolutely is good reasons why. But it's not inherently virtuous. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have an inherent virtue. The people who came ashore then were using commons customs and commons organizations to dispossess other people who had their own practices that you could say were also commons practices and commons customs. It was dispossession by commons. Mm-hmm. So the first thing that I want to say is that private property did not actually colonize North America, but actually commoners did. And that may be uncomfortable for some people to hear. So I don't want this to be to sound too technical, okay? But that true enclosure, as it was basically innovated and invented in England, was essentially an immediate transition of taking a commons and turning it into private property. It was a way of lords, for all kinds of reasons at this time in the 16th and 17th century, were insisting that the old way of doing things wasn't really serving their interest anymore. Mm-hmm. So they finally succeeded in having Parliament pass these laws, actual laws. This is the government essentially taking common property and turning it into a designation, a kind of basically collecting all of these rights, bundling them together and handing them to lords. That was something entirely new that came to be called real estate or private property altogether. But what the United States did and some of the colonies did to indigenous people was essentially use a large public entity to take that money. It was dispossession, absolutely. And it sounds a little bit tactical to say that it wasn't enclosure in that formal sense. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, was it turned into private property? Ultimately, it was. Absolutely. But it belonged to a public entity before it belonged to a private entity, which is why it doesn't quite qualify as enclosure. Again, it's just going to sound a little bit technical, but to say that they were dispossessed on the way to producing private property is just probably a more accurate way of saying it. That's all. But private property came to the colonies. By about 1750, I would say, private property was fairly firmly established. And it was the kind of the dominant way that that whites in the colonies were thinking about land and through the ownership of land. I have to say, and this is a little bit of a jump, that indigenous people today are seeking private property rights because they understand that the only way to protect themselves collectively is in fact to own land legally with a deed in such a way that it can't be taken away or infringed upon. So that now, even though there are still many of them are seeking a kind of collective ownership, they are doing so within a realm of private property is really the only way that they can they can do this.
Interesting. So I want to get into what do we do now or the current situation. You proposed the Commons Communities Act. Before we get into that, I want to ask if there's anything else about kind of the history that you feel like we should highlight that we haven't discussed yet before we kind of move on to current day.
No, I guess that's all.
Okay.
We've covered it.
Yeah. Cool. And so obviously today, you know, 21st century modernity, you know, we're in a entirely new context, entirely new setting. For me, a big area of my interest is, is something like an agrarian revival desirable and possible, right? Given that, you know, we've already cracked a lot of the eggs, et cetera. And you propose this Commons Communities Act, but just more generally, how do you think about this situation today, maybe not just in Appalachia, but globally about, you know, we're in this global capitalist system. In many ways, it's unsustainable. It's still very exploitative around the world. You know, where do we go from here? You know, in say the next 100 years, in an ideal scenario, there's plenty of doomsday scenarios. We're called doomer optimism. We're trying to recognize immense challenges that we face today, but also not become fatalistic, right? Do you want to characterize kind of how you're thinking about this today and where we can and should move forward?
I have to tell you that, get back to me in like a year because the last chapter of this book about land is I want to grapple with some of these things. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure out myself exactly what I would want to see lumped under this term land reform. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be honest with you, as I sit here right now, I'm not really sure. Because there are so many moving parts. What do you do with the state? What role does the state play in this? I can tell you that I don't want the state to own all the land and then to make decisions about how it's used. I don't think that's a good way to go. I'm not an anti-statist. In fact, in many ways, I really want to believe that there can be a nation state that can behave in the interest of regular people. It's just, I'm not that much of a statist to say that the state needs to own and control everything, because in the real world, I think that's ridiculous. But at the same time, I'm not willing to see private property remain as it is right now.
Yeah.
I am not. I do think that it's okay for people to own their homes. I do. In fact, it may sound funny, but the way that most Americans think of private property as owning a house, I would argue, isn't actually private property at all. Okay, it's private property in the sense that you own it. But when I say private property, I'm talking about capitalist private property, which is private property that you don't live on, that basically earns an income, that essentially is something that earns, that produces ground rent, or that you use to build a factory that then employs people and that you, you know, exploits them or whatever, right? But your house doesn't do that. In fact, your house is a liability. It's a hole in the ground that you pour money into. It's a bad investment in almost every situation. I would be willing to say, go ahead and own your house. The question is what to do with this other realm. And the people, you know, maybe 500 people or so who own tens of millions of acres of the United States. The government owns most of the United States, mm-hmm. by far. But lots of other people own millions and millions of acres. And what do we do about that? Mm-hmm. How does that get distributed? What do you do about the fact that we're not peasants who want a farm? Most people have no intention and no desire of being a farmer. If there is some form of land reform, then they're going to have to benefit in some monetary way through the redistribution of what? Profit through the tax system? Maybe. That was like what Henry George was calling for at the end of the 19th century. And that is, he would say something like, well, you didn't produce this land as a commodity. It existed by nature or by God. Therefore, you don't deserve to have all the profit from it. So through the tax system, he wanted to collect what the money you made by owning your, you know, your factory or your ranch or whatever, and the ground rent, and redistribute that to people who didn't own land. Maybe that makes sense. So there's a lot of moving parts and it's really complicated, but I would say that land is really important, more than I think people realize, for the way that we think about ourselves as citizens and kind of who owns America and our stake in it. But that private property has a very bad record of preserving the environment. Like you suggested, we're living in a time of unprecedented ecological crisis. Every landscape and species is basically in free fall. And the era of private property ushered in, it was essentially the foundation of capitalism that ultimately spawned the coal-driven industrial economy that has arguably just wrecked everything. So going back and thinking about property itself and land itself, and trying to create ways in which people could live in a commons if they choose to, I think is worth thinking about.
Yeah.
And that's not the most radical way of thinking, but you could have people on your show who have a much more radical way of thinking about it. And mine isn't. I'm really interested in kind of reform as revolution. Mm-hmm. That is to say that the two things are not contraindicated, mm-hmm. and that a series of reforms can add up to a very major change. And even someone like Karl Marx was not in any way against reform. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm settled on. The revolution has a really bad record of taking care of people and ending up in and having any kind of democratic process. And
right.
That's just where I am.
It makes sense. Well, yeah, I mean, one thing that's related to what you said that I noticed in your points about your sections in the Commons Community Act is that you talk about that, you know, initially the government would basically set aside land for commons that would be mostly managed by the commoners, but they would also provide these other services, education, you know, extension, you know, services for agriculture. What's that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But they also had the option of basically taking over that ownership, maybe something like a community land trust, you know, with the caveat that then the federal community services would also be retracted as well. And so you kind of instilled this flexibility for these communities, whether they wanted the benefits and the burdens of, you know, being part of a federal structure or not. And I thought that was interesting, that kind of flexibility you included in there.
I kind of was walking a line. I mean, mm-hmm. I was trying to think about the kind of people who I'm addressing.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like really conservative people out there who hunt and fish. And it's like, how would they be interested in doing something like this and not see themselves as a bunch of communists, you know? And I actually imagined that I was writing a book that might actually appeal to some conservatives.
Yeah.
Right. And there was a kind of, right?
I definitely noticed throughout the book that you were, I mean, in some ways your proposals and your analysis could be considered radical, but in other ways it's very conservative. It's conserving communities, conserving autonomy, community autonomy, et cetera. And so I thought you did a good job of making that balance.
Did you like the Commons Community Act? Do you think it's a workable thing?
I really liked it. It's hard to imagine now the federal government. I just can't imagine the political pathway at the moment. To get there. One thing that's we kind of always bounce on this show, because I mean, a lot of us are very interested in kind of local agroecological food systems in general. We see that as necessity. We're interested in, a lot of us think that we will have to localize a lot of food production, and that will mean a lot more people getting back involved with agriculture. We don't quite know the mechanism of how that would work for people to actually want to do that. But then the question of access to land. And, we talk, okay, there's land reform that's instantiated by the federal government or a state government or a county. But then there's also like the community land trust movements. Some places you have like agricultural reserves. I know in like Maryland, you have, forget the name of that reserve, that seems pretty successful. We've talked to people associated with that. And so there's different ways to think about, but the bottom line is, assuming, and this is a big assumption, that in the future, due to maybe certain biophysical reasons about food security, the importance of food traditions and ecological degradation, that people will want to get back involved with at least part-time food production, but they don't have access to land, that's going to be a big challenge. And so what are ways that we can think about doing that are not totalitarian, top-down? We don't want a Maoist revolution. Right. And so we're just actively kind of thinking through strategies. And so I thought what you put forward was very interesting. I'd love to see a coalition built around that, but I'm not sure if I see that signs of that at the moment. And I'm curious
how you thought. Part of my research in West Virginia was called sitting on a bar stool talking to people. Yeah. Whenever I went into a restaurant or something, I always sat at the bar and I always talked to the person next to me, usually, a male of some kind. And I can't tell you how many times I heard someone say, I work for a coal company. I'm an engineer. Mm-hmm. I work for the county.
Yeah.
I work for the agricultural experiment station. But all I really want is a little piece of land, a pickup truck, and I want to hunt and fish and grow a garden. And people really said that, more than once. I heard that. So the thing about the Commons Communities Act is there are people doing this right now. They hunt, they fish, and they have pretty large gardens. What would happen if they governed themselves? Mm. And they had real control over a whole piece of land, like a really big thousands of acres that they manage as a community together. I don't think is a crazy idea.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it to be this kind of just a kind of a lefty project, which of course it really is. But I wanted to give them a kind of autonomy and power over it to make it what they want it to be. But I didn't want it to turn into an enclave of crazy right-wing violence and, this white supremacist crap. What do? So the federal government has to play a role in it. So that's kind of the line that I was walking through it versus autonomy and that they could take it offline themselves, away from the government, I suppose. And also, you know, in the book, at the end of the book, there's this New Deal project called the Division of Subsistence Homesteads. Just saying it, you can't even believe that such a thing existed. Mm-hmm. But they screwed it up. They botched the whole thing. Because the first thing they did was they put everybody in debt so they had to work in a factory. And I don't know why they chose to do that. It was crazy. It destroyed the whole idea. Or here they were producing their own food, but they had to work in a factory to work off the debt of the whole project. They basically took the coal camp and they made that the model. for the federal government subsistence homestead. It was ridiculous. What if the federal government did it right? And the way that it would do it right is there's no debt to begin with, zero debt. Here's the land, go ahead, live on it and do something out of it. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
I don't think it really appealed to a lot of people.
Well, it appealed to me, but I don't have much political power besides the class, so. And the students that I teach in my classroom.
Yeah. Me either. The book was reviewed in the New York Times by J.D. Vance.
Oh, boy. Okay.
I like to say it was before J.D. Vance really dropped off the deep end. He was a little bit more of a thoughtful conservative.
Yeah.
He disagreed with the book, but he said nice things about it.
Yeah.
He said that he learned from it. But he also, I don't believe he commented on this.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great. Well, we have about 10 more minutes or so. So do you want to maybe let's broaden this out to international context. I remember you mentioning that, you know, a lot of this land dispossession is of course still going on in Africa, for example, in many countries in Africa, it's still going on. Part of my dissertation research, I was looking at food systems in East Africa. And I know that like international policy institutions are really pushing basically this idea of structural transformation of we need to mimic the Western model of industrialized agriculture. We need to make agriculture more productive. Implied in that is that a lot of people will be leaving agriculture. There is, I know, some debate of should they move to the cities, but the cities are ballooning, you know, urbanization is happening very quickly, or should we try and bolster the rural non-farm economies? And there's some debate on that, but of course, then you have a lot of just private investors. You have China, you have the United States, you know, speculating on this land, you know, and that's just Africa. Of course, it's happening all over the world. Do you want to kind of talk about the global situation that you see and how this relates to that context?
Well, you know much more about Africa than I do. So I just dipped into this one case of a sugar company, a Dutch company that made this huge gambit in Mali. And otherwise, I don't study Africa, but I was fascinated by this example. And the thing I think, if I'm going to generalize, I think the thing to be very wary of is a kind of win-win attitude. Because in win-wins, someone's going to lose. And it really is meant to hide the real winners, which would people who basically end up, corporations who end up with wage laborers on land that the laborers have in fact very little control over at all. And that's what I saw in this case going on.
Yeah.
From the point of view of certain African nations, they have these peasants who have controlled this land for hundreds of thousands of years. And this land produces no value for them. And the peasants have no legal title to this land, as peasants never do, because they owned the land before there was any government or legal title, when they had control over it. So this is also how enclosure works, is you basically substitute a legal structure for one that is based on customary rights. Right, with the argument saying they don't own it because you just invented a new version of ownership and then you say they don't qualify, right? This is what certain people want African societies to do. And, you know, the problem is that if there are peasants and they are poor and they're not doing well, this becomes an excuse for dispossessing them instead of asking, what can we do for these peasant producers that'll make their lives more stable and that will help them produce? That's never asked. The idea is that the way they do things is inherently flawed when it survived for thousands of years. Instead of asking, how can we use certain tools that'll actually make it better for them? And because that's not the intention. The intention is to find a way to steal it. So I would say to people, be very wary of someone saying, well, these people are so poor, they live on $1.50 a day, right? As though, right? You understand what that is.
Yeah, as though their subsistence depended on the monetary formal economy.
Right. You're translating something into money terms that really can't be. And then you're giving it this money value. And people say, $1.50 a day. How could they possibly live? Because they're not living on $1.50 a day. You're just revaluing it in that term because you think that's what it would earn if they sold their labor, if they sold whatever they produce on the market. I don't even know where this term comes from, $1.50 a day, $1 a day.
Yeah.
But it's all intended to delegitimize them.
Yeah.
And as a way of taking their land. That's what I would say about what's happening all over the third world. Mm-hmm. Is everybody now has designs on Africa. Look at all of this land. It's near rivers. Yeah. It's got this ideal climate. Just think of all we can produce, all the rice, the sugar, the coffee that we can make if we can just find some way to get a hold of it. And that's the kind of the frontier of enclosure. It's still going on. The capitalist revolution and the revolution of taking land from people has never stopped, even though we don't see it any longer.
Yeah, well, one thing I really appreciated about your book is because, as you said, you know, oftentimes I think for Americans, they hear about enclosure and it's always, oh, that was in the past or that's somewhere else. But what your book demonstrates is that, no, this very much happened here as well, multiple times, right? And it doesn't matter if you're indigenous or white, it might have happened to your ancestors as well, right? There's everybody kind of has skin in this game and it's still happening. And so I really appreciated, I think, you know, making it more relevant to the kind of the American mind in a way, which, you know, I thought was very helpful.
Capitalism has to continually draw fresh land and extremely inexpensive human labor. It has to, it's like a vortex, and it has to draw it into itself. Yeah. If labor becomes too expensive and if land becomes too expensive, then it actually can't function, because what happens on these peripheries is essential for what goes on in the core. Right. It's why China, after exploiting its own people, after having factories and turning villages and sending all these people and putting them together, land and labor, into this incredibly profitable amalgam, where at one time there was like 15, 20, 30% profit every year, all that has slowed down in China. And now China is in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Latin America and many other parts of the world as well, yeah.
Not an accident. That they're looking to recapture some of these incredible profit margins by doing in Africa what they did to their own people in their own internal periphery. Mm-hmm. United States, of course, has tried to do the same thing, though differently.
Yeah.
So this is why we have to keep an eye out on Africa.
Yeah. Okay. So I know you have to go, but last question. You mentioned that, you know, these days, oftentimes, like indigenous populations today or others, you know, they actually want, you know, kind of the formal land title of private property, because it's only by playing in the system can you kind of, you know, protect your system. But if we're imagining kind of, and you also mentioned that, you know, historically peasants haven't formally owned their land, what would it mean an ideal system for agrarians to have, you know, kind of say community ownership of their land, some kind of commons framework, as well as, you know, long-term land tenure for individual households, et cetera. You know, what would that look like moving forward if we were to design, you know, would that be something like a community land trust, which is a pretty new kind of, you know, set of movements, or would it be something else?
Well, I love that. You've heard of that company, that organization, the Agrarian Trust. Are you familiar with them?
I don't know much about it, but I've heard of it, yeah.
You should interview. You should have them on your show.
Yeah, I think I will.
What they do is they buy land, put it into the trust so that it can never be sold again, then give it to farmers at next to nothing so that they have no land cost. They have no mortgage to pay, and they produce food for themselves and for larger communities, however that is defined.
Yeah.
I love the idea of a community land trust.
Yeah.
I love the idea that people would be given membership in this, and live there and, you know, do whatever they do, but they would be able to live there and to eat from there for nothing, for next to nothing, in exchange only for their own labor. And, you know, if you had to earn a wage off of, you know, and work for somewhere else, fine, you know, fine. Yeah. But you wouldn't, but you'd be free not to have to make a lot of money, because so much of your subsistence would be produced by your own community. Mm-hmm. It would really be liberating.
Yeah.
Imagine having a part-time job producing all the money that you need to buy, I don't know, dishes, you right. know, or whatever you're going to buy. Mm-hmm. I would love to see something like that. And I think this is entirely workable and not, you know, utopian.
Yeah.
I think that what I really want to say is that, I want to see people think more imaginatively about that future. Yeah. And that what I see in my own students is what one author calls capitalist realism.
Yeah.
It is this idea since maybe the fall of the Soviet Union, perhaps, that there are no more alternatives to capitalism. This is it. That's it. Yeah. It is so real that we're no longer going to even think about an alternative. Yeah. Our role is to find a way to fit into it and to survive within it.
Yeah.
And there's no way to think outside of it any longer.
Yeah.
And how it's at one hand the ultimate triumph of capitalism, and on the other hand, it's really, really dangerous for capitalism, because for it to fail itself would leave people really, you know, unmoored. Yeah. So I see this in my own students is like the future feels sort of like a flattened landscape. It doesn't have a lot of options in it, yeah. except figuring out which way you're going to go to earn the largest possible income that you can and pay off your student debts and things like that. And it's bleak.
Yeah.
So thinking imaginatively about it and saying, look, these are workable things. There's no reason why this can't work. I'm not talking about, you know, some different kind of human that we need to design to live within it.
Yeah.
I'm interested in all these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so am I. I also try that. I teach college classes. I also try to convey a sense of, you know, the future is open. It's not completely predetermined. And also, I think on this podcast, we're always trying to imagine what are possible workable alternatives. You know, what are pragmatic alternatives. So I appreciate you saying that. So I'll let you go again for the audience. I really, really love this book. I highly recommend it. You should definitely read it. It's about Appalachia, but it's not just about Appalachia. It's about lands and rights of communities to have access to land in general. So please check it out. And I really appreciate your time, Stephen. I had a great time.
Thank you, Jason. That's really nice of you. Thank you for inviting me.